Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for being with us. If you're listening in real time, it's Friday afternoon. This show is the only thing that stands between many of us and a weekend. So we'll see how that goes. Jim Galloway, you're looking askance at my comments.
Speak for yourself. Okay. I've got a this is crunch day for me.
All right,
especially since that noon deadline.
Yeah, and we're going to talk in a few minutes about, of course, the final tallies and a final look at who's officially now qualified to run for offices across the state of Georgia. That's Jim Galloway. He's the lead political writer for the AJC. He also oversees the Political Insider blog on politicallygeorgia.com, Politically Georgia as part of myajc.com. And you read him in the Dead Tree edition on Wednesdays and Sundays. Hi, Jim. Thanks for being here.
It's a great day.
Julianne Thompson joins us today. She is a longtime activist in Republican Party politics. She has been an officer in the state Republican Party. And Julianne, why don't we let you tell people right away that you're going to be tomorrow night, you hope, making some news up in Gwinnett County.
Yes, the Gwinnett County Republican Party is going to be hosting a gubernatorial debate tomorrow night at Norcross High School. The doors are going to open at 6 p.m., and people with tickets will be seated first, and then it will be open to the public on a first-come, first-served basis after that. And additionally, on March 29th, the 7th Congressional District is going to be hosting a GOP primary debate in Forsyth County, and I'm going to be moderating that.
All right,
so looking
terrific.
Forward to it.
All right. We will, on Monday, look to see if there's some news that we can talk about on our show coming out of there. Michael Owens joins us. He is the chair of the Cobb County Democratic Party. It's great to have you back with us.
Hey, great to be here.
We're going to talk to you about a number of issues that relate to Cobb County, especially the surprise entrance of a Democratic woman challenging, who hopes to win the primary and go on to challenge Karen Handel in the 6th Congressional District. We'll get to that in a little while. And Loretta Lepore is back with us. She's a Republican strategist. She was Governor Sonny Perdue's communications director back when he was in the State House, and she was the co-chair of the Carly Fiorina presidential campaign here in Georgia. Hi, Loretta.
Hi, good to be here today.
It's nice to have you here. And for all of you out there who are listening to us across the state, you know we always love having you join us on the radio. Remember, you can go to Facebook, to the GPB News page on Facebook, and watch the show now on Facebook Live. We've been getting really thrilling results. There have been an awful lot of people who have chosen to watch the show on Facebook. So whether it's on the radio or on Facebook, we love having you with us.
Yeah, people don't seem to mind how we look.
Let me give you one quick story that developed today, broke today. Governor Deal has now signed the amended 2018 fiscal year budget. It's just to point out what's involved in it. There's a great deal of money for K through 12 enrollment growth. There's airport runway extension money. There's money for forest land protection, which is interesting. There's money for technical colleges. There's $28.2 million for the Indigent Care Trust Fund and Medicaid, Jim, but there's nothing startling really in the budget to my mind.
No. I'll point to you that the bill was signed in Polk County. The
yes.
Deal had an event out there because there's money in there for a 5,000-foot extension of the runway.
Right there.
And that's how kind of minute it gets.
Yes, but the reason it's worth pointing out is that these runway extensions are thought to be one aspect of a larger plan, hopefully, to begin to find ways to get the economy of rural places in Georgia
right,
moving
right. This,
again.
This way you get these business CEOs in their jets and down on the ground.
Yeah, okay. Jim, we do want to really start with what I thought was a surprising story. You all reported on it on Political Insider. We've talked about the fact from the day that she first introduced it, that Republican Megan Hansen, a House member from up in Brookhaven, introduced a hate crimes bill that I think we all treated with great skepticism. I certainly did. I asked the question.
Oh, I certainly did. You're right. Yeah.
I said, does Megan Hansen know what she's getting into? This is a very thorny thicket. It sounds very lovely on the surface, but it's complicated. The bill did not move forward.
Did not even get a hearing.
But as we pointed out on our show on Crossover Day, you never, never call a bill dead until the 40th day is gaveled to a close.
Right. They're only mostly dead.
So what happened?
All right. What we had was we had the House Judiciary Committee meet on Thursday, chaired by Wendell Willard, who is exiting after this session, and wanted something to add to his legacy. He took most of the contents of Megan Hansen's bill, HB 660, and put it into Senate Bill 373, which was a dead bill that had passed out of the Senate in order to give Cobb County an extra Superior Court judgeship, which they later found out that they didn't need. So you take that bill, you put in your hate crime bill, and you add a list of things that it covers. And this one covers religion, it covers sexual orientation, gender, homeless status, national origin, a couple others. The original version of the bill also would have offered protection to people who are attacked. It would have added penalties to people who attack others because of their political views.
Yeah, but that was pulled out of the bill.
Over the objections of because the ADL objected
to
that.
The anti-defamation league.
They thought it might be used to protect neo-Nazis.
Go ahead.
There was a little bit, there was some pushback by Georgia Equality saying the gender identity needed to be added. And they think they've got a small workaround. They've included sexual orientation and gender. And they think, you know, to combine those two might serve that purpose, but they voted specifically to not to add the word identity.
So, Loretta, let's just very briefly frame this in the history of Georgia politics over the last 20 years almost. In 2000, the Georgia legislature passed a hate crimes bill. It was signed into law by the governor. But in 2004, the Georgia Supreme Court struck it down because it didn't have what they call enumerated classes. It didn't talk about specific people or groups of people who would be protected by this. And in fact, Justice Carol Hunstein at the time wrote that she thought that it could be appropriate to have a hate crimes law, but that the one that was enacted did not give people of ordinary intelligence a specific enough warning of what conduct to avoid. So in the years since then, the legislature has never, we are one of five states that does not have a hate crimes law. And the legislature has refused to do so, largely because for many years, legislators did not want to in any way codify and protect gays and lesbians. That was a sticking point throughout. So this has got a long and storied history, which is why it's really stunning that it comes up today and looks like it's on track to at least get a fair hearing.
Well, I think also we're looking at a new time culturally that we live in, where there is greater tolerance. And I think when Chairman Willard brought up this bill and was speaking to the bill, he referenced the 1960s as he was growing up here and how he, much to his embarrassment now, didn't stand up to some of the injustices that were occurring during the civil rights movement. And perhaps this is his way to come back and correct some of that. It's important to note that Megan Hansen and Wendell Willard's districts are adjacent. And I think it's interesting that you have a very veteran, seasoned lawmaker working with a young, first-term lawmaker. Megan Hansen, her predecessor in that House district was an openly gay candidate, Taylor Bennett, who was well-liked. She has a candidate very similar to Taylor Bennett that she is running against in this election. But I think more importantly, you've seen a changing shift in dynamic in both of their districts and in the electorate within both of their districts and in the metro region more broadly, where tolerance and acceptance is more important today than it was in the past.
Julianne, I want you to check me on this. I think it is fair to say that for a long time, Republican legislators, conservative legislators, and there may have been Democrats in that mix too, did not want to acknowledge that the law should protect gays and lesbians against hate crimes. Tell me your take on the fact this thing has come to life late in the session.
Well, I think that there are a lot of Republicans, myself included, that have mixed emotions about hate crime legislation. I think on one hand, it's very important to draw a distinct differentiation between ordinary graffiti and, say, something like drawing a swastika on a temple. There's very much of a difference there. That's obviously a hate crime. Where I have a problem with it is when you're talking about rape or murder or a violent crime like that that seems to value one life more than another, to add another layer of punishment just because it was done against a specific person that's under one of these protected classes. It should just be wrong and harshly punished no matter what.
Yeah, I think part of the debate yesterday, Bill mentioned had some objections from the Georgia Baptists, and the phrase establishing a hierarchy of victims was used.
We should point out, Michael, this is a penalty. This calls for enhanced penalties. It is not a separate crime.
Right.
If you are, taking Julianne's example, if you're arrested for painting graffiti on a synagogue, if that graffiti is anti-Semitic in nature, you'd be found guilty of whatever the misdemeanor is. Well, I guess in a misdemeanor crime, you wouldn't have anything. But the point is, even if it's a felony conviction, then the hate crime statute would come into play as an enhancement.
Yeah, that's the part of that makes it, as you said earlier, complicated, right? And the idea that you're knowingly, willfully doing this against this protected class, or, you know, whether it's a swastika or whether it's just some graffiti. But it's already a crime. It is already a crime. We do need to protect those in that class, but I do think it could be a slippery slope, just depending. But from a pure political standpoint, I mean, I think, Loretta, you mentioned the fact that the idea of Megan Hansen in this election running against, I think it's, is it Wilson? The candidate?
I'm sorry. I don't know the candidate offhand.
I don't know him, but obviously, you know, hate crime legislation coming up in a district that is kind of leaning towards being a Democrat, or at least a very purplish district, would be a very good reason to come up with a hate crime legislation when you're in a district that is really starting to trend towards candidates like the previous House district that we had over there.
Right. Bill, just as a measure of what a slick move this is, is because the Senate has already passed this bill, this is SB 373 now, regardless of the contents. Because the Senate has passed this bill, if this gets to the House floor and the House approves it and sends it back to the Senate, it receives only an up or down vote, a yes vote from the full Senate floor.
Right.
There's no holding it in committee.
And that, it's interesting you point that out, because that really ties the hands of conservatives in the Senate who might feel uncomfortable with moving forward on
right,
this
right, right, and or with say maybe eliminating sexual orientation,
yes,
or something,
oh, right,
from,
exactly,
from the bill itself, yeah,
exactly. So check me on this, one of you. If the bill passed out of House Judiciary, when it goes to the floor, these bills that suddenly come back to life because they're attached to an existing bill that bears some resemblance in code, mm-hmm, to what they're trying to do, this thing could someone challenge whether this is germane to the original bill, and could that kill it?
Well, it has to be. It has to be the same code section.
Yes, okay.
So it has to be in that sense. It's germane.
But a parliamentarian could say it's the same code section, but it doesn't bear any real relevance, couldn't they? Am I wrong about that?
Well, before it would get to the floor, it would have to go through the Rules Committee,
okay,
and it would be vetted. That type of issue would come up in the Rules Committee.
But this is a bill sponsored by the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. So.
What are the chances this thing is going to happen? Somebody tell me whether we think this is going to pass.
I would say it's, you know, it may not be 50-50, but it's at least 45% chance now.
Wow. Julianne, is this a campaign issue for some people out there, Republicans, some conservative Republicans?
I don't know that it's a campaign issue. I guess we'll have to wait and see if it actually happens. I think Jim is right that it does have a really good chance of you know, making it to the floor. I think that you also bring up a good point that even though it's technically germane, a parliamentarian could, or I'm sure there will be members of the House that bring up whether or not it is truly germane to the original bill. But I'm sure that they plan on waiting until day 40 to do this, to bring it to the floor.
Our friend Todd Rehm tweets about Taylor Bennett, the comment that he is openly gay. His mother, I believe, he ran during the campaign on the fact, I believe, that she,
yes, she is gay. She
not
is gay.
That he,
sorry.
Not that he. That's all right. We just want to correct the record. All right. Qualifying ended for all races at noon today, Jim Galloway. And a sea change could be shaping up.
It's we've got what I think is our first concrete evidence of a female wave in Georgia. Whether it's the Donald Trump backlash, whether it's the Me Too movement, but our intern Ella Elisar just finished crunching the numbers for us, just for state House and state Senate races. We're not talking about statewide races here, okay? All right. In 2016, we had 87 women run for the state House. This year, we have 115. In 2016, there were 55 of those were Democrats. This year, 79 of them are Democrats. Republicans have seen hardly any gains in female participation in the House. It was 32 in 2016, 35 this year. In the Senate, 19 women total ran in 2016. This year, 31. 12 Democrats in 2016, this year 26, and there are actually fewer Republican women running for the Senate this year than in 2016. In the House, Bob Trammell tells me that Democrats have fielded 121 total candidates, 79 are women. That's two-thirds.
Yeah.
This is huge.
We should also point out, we'll drill down on the fact that so many women have qualified, but we should also point out, Michael, we're going to see far more contested legislative seats this election, whether it's by men or women, than we've seen since
2004,
right,
I think.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. What's happening, Michael?
What's happening is that this sea change that Jim's talked about is real, right? And we're seeing this not only in Metro Atlanta, we're seeing this across the entire state. A lot of them are new, first-time candidates, people that really got energized and got involved in electoral politics and campaigning during the last presidential election. But we're seeing this all across. In Cobb County, we have literally filled every partisan race, with the exception of two, in the entire county. So majority of those are women.
What are the two that you didn't get covered?
The two we did not is Senate District 37, Lindsay Tippins.
Okay.
And County Commission District 1, which is Bob Weatherford.
Mm-hmm.
Besides that, every
both are in the northwest corner.
Both
of Cobb.
Are northwest Cobb, which is our most challenged area.
Yeah, pretty Republican area. Julianne, you were really out there, and you've said on this show on a number of occasions, we need more women candidates in the Republican Party. It just didn't happen despite your best efforts.
I think that you're absolutely correct, and I think that that we do need to be fielding more female candidates. I think that it's something that we need to see across the nation, not just across the state, but I'm very disappointed that we don't have more female candidates. Extremely disappointed as far as the statewide races are concerned. There's only two, one for insurance commissioner and one for state school superintendent. And that's it. Only two females on the Republican side running for statewide office.
Plus Tricia Pridemore on the PSC side.
On the PSC, but yeah.
But, you know, it within the Democratic Party, and I'll say just left of center as a whole, this hasn't happened just by happenstance, right? There are training programs, there are tons of training programs that are out there specifically geared for women. There's recruitment efforts that are being made from the grassroots level all the way up through the DNC, where we're actively going out and asking women to get engaged, asking them to step up and run. So, you know, and as mentioned before, I've been on here, it's not necessarily anti-Trump. It's more the empowerment of women to step up and actually run. It's not an anti-Trump movement as much as it is that women should have a seat at the table and have a place in the House.
Bill, we had Melita Easters with Georgia Windlist on the program on Monday, I think. And we talked afterwards, and she said, previous to the 2016 presidential race, Windlist, they have year-long training programs.
Georgia Windlist is an organization that was founded by Melita to recruit women candidates, Democratic women who are pro-choice.
Pro-choice. Okay. All right. They have year-long classes in how to be a candidate. Mm-hmm. Before 2016, the classes averaged 20. In 2017, the class size was 80, four times.
So, Loretta, Michael goes to great pains to say, well, this may not be anti-Trump. On the other hand, what we've seen in a number of special elections, certainly in Virginia, then in Alabama, in Virginia, the governor's race, Alabama, the U.S. Senate race, is women, particularly suburban women, abandoning their what might have been their traditional Republican base and voting against the Republican candidate. So is there not a Trump component to all of this?
You know, I think I have to agree with Michael in the respect that, you know, there may be a Trump effect in a slight way. There may be a Me Too movement effect in a slight way. But the more important part is what Michael highlighted. On the Democratic side, for years, they have had grassroots organizing and training programs to recruit women to the fold. The Republican Party has not done that, and to date still has not really been active in that regard. When you look at organizations like Emily's List, mm-hmm. which has, you know, over $500 million to recruit and to fund and train women, you know, the Republican side just hasn't organized
right,
that way.
But,
and I will say that the organizations, and there are more female Republican organizations on board onlining and raising funds and recruiting women. Winning for Women is one that launched this year. You know, Right Now Women is, but they're all at the federal level. So you don't have a pipeline. You're not cultivating local level women who will then run
right,
for national
but
office.
But I want to challenge something you said, and Julianne, you please pick up on this. You said maybe this is to some extent because of the Me Too movement. Well, the Me Too movement, there's no reason why that should be partisan. I mean, among the high-profile people who were caught up in that, Senator Al Franken, the Democrat from Minnesota. But what Loretta is, you probably didn't necessarily mean
No, I didn't mean,
this,
I didn't mean that partisan specific. I meant it gender specific.
But,
so it was more women
but
are turning
But the women are
out.
Running for Democratic offices, not Republican offices.
I don't think it's I understand exactly what she meant, but I don't think it's about the Me Too movement at all. I think it's more about why not me?
Right,
you know,
exactly.
I think we're to that point in society and in history now where we know that we have to step up
but
to
Jim,
the plate.
They're
and,
seeing,
and,
okay,
but
they're
I don't,
all right. Okay, I've got to jump in here. I distinctly remember seeing several hundred thousand women on the streets of D.C. and tens of thousands of women on the streets of Atlanta on the day after inauguration in 2017. I can't imagine that there's no relationship to that.
I don't think it's an anti-Trump thing. I'm giving it to the Democrats on this. I think it is about their proactive hard work in recruiting female candidates.
All right. It's whatever. It is really an interesting.
I think there's a big difference between running for office. That's a huge commitment than turning out mm-hmm. in a protest. Are
exactly.
women activated against what perhaps President Trump represents or what conservative ideology is or what's happening in Washington? Absolutely. But that is a whole different mindset
okay.
than putting yourself in play for an office at the local or national level.
Fair enough. Let's do this. We've got a break that we have to get in right now. When we come back, I want to clean up this qualifying story because there are a couple of really interesting little anecdotal themes that have run through it that are worth talking about. But right now, let's get a break in. This is Political Rewind.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Drive away. Drive so far.
where are you listening to Political Rewind? If it's not your car, then and you're at home or you're in your office near a computer, then go to GPB News Facebook page and watch the live stream of the show. We love having you look in the radio studio while we're doing the program today. Just a couple of quick notes on qualifying. These are fun little stories. Etham Pham, I hope I'm saying that right, Pham, is running for a 7th District congressional seat, and he sent out a news release late yesterday saying that he was racing his campaign team to the Capitol. They were doing it on Facebook Live. He was going to go to the Doraville MARTA station and come to the Capitol on MARTA. His team was driving in, and they were going to see who got there first.
I can't honestly tell you what the results were.
I don't know that yet
there was,
either.
There was no checkered flag that I saw.
It was kind of fun. R.J. Hadley, he decided in his race he's been a perennial candidate in the past.
He's got 6 statewide races under his belt, and he's running for Secretary of State.
Yes. And, so on his official qualifying papers, he put the slogan, Wakanda Forever, a reference to Black Panther, which is kind of fun. And Jim, this one's kind of close to home for you. There's a young man from, up in North Cobb. His name is Kyle Rinaldo. He graduated from North Cobb High School just in 2014. He says he's the youngest candidate to run for legislature.
And this year, I think he is. He's young enough that my daughter taught him at North Cobb. he's running against Ed Setzler, a Republican from Ackworth.
That's a tough race for you, Michael.
It's definitely a tough race. I've spoken with Kyle. Impressive young man, but young indeed. He just graduated from Georgetown and kind of came back, but he is from that district. He was born and raised there, so he thinks he's gonna have some traction.
He joins this list of young people in, you know, we haven't talked about it on the show, but in the state of Kansas, I think it's Kansas, we have 5 teenagers running for governor because there's no age requirement for the office.
Right. Another race, if I can draw your attention to the school superintendent race, we've got John Barge, former school superintendent, running against in the Republican primary against incumbent Richard Woods. But on the Democratic side, you've got an interesting candidate, Sid Chapman, president of the Georgia Association of Educators. And the Georgia Association of Educators just endorsed a Democratic candidate for governor named Stacey Abrams.
Stacey Abrams, right.
So to me, this looks like it could be the
putting
the start,
a ticket together.
Putting a ticket together. Yes, sir.
Interesting.
Well, also interesting. The other candidate, other Democrat in that race, Otho Thornton, I think, was the president of the National PTA. I thought that was interesting. So both of them are pretty high profile candidates from an education standpoint.
So, Loretta and Julianne, to close out this talk about qualifying, and, you know, Jim pointing out all the women running on the Democratic side, and the fact there are more, whether it's men or women, contested Republican seats than we've seen since your former boss, Sonny Perdue, became governor. Is any of this portend a changing of the power structure at the state capitol in terms of the majority party?
Well, I mean, I don't think we're going to see a new majority.
Okay. Well, that's why I think it's important to make that point.
Right.
Okay.
But we are likely to see a good bit of pickup by Democrats this cycle.
I agree. We could see the, you know, supermajority chipped away at, and, you know, but we're going to remain a majority for at least a while, hopefully a very long while.
Yeah, I just don't want to leave our listeners with the thought in their heads that we think this could mean that suddenly Democrats will take over at the state capitol. Both Jim Galloway, who is sitting to my left, and Michael Owen sitting to my right at almost the same time asked me with little notes not to forget Lucy McBath. Who is she and why should we talk about her, Michael?
Sure. So Lucy McBath is national spokesperson for the Moms, I'm going to mess this up, but Moms Demand Action for Guns, a national organization of mothers to advocate for gun reform, gun safety. And she's been in that role for several years now. Her son was actually a victim of a gun shooting and killed. So Lucy has been very active as of late, And she actually threw her hat in the ring early on to run for House District 37, which state house race in Cobb County. And Tuesday and on into Wednesday, there was a shift there, and she decided she was going to run for U.S. Congress in the 6th District. So the congressional district that Congresswoman Karen Handel now has, the special election last year between her and John Ossoff, she decided to get in that race. So that definitely shakes things up a lot on the Democratic side, and I think it changes the whole complexity of the race, whereas you had two white males that was running before, Bobby Capel and Kevin Abel, who are both fine candidates themselves. But I think in the national mood that you have right now going on with, you know, the unfortunate school shootings and just gun reform being a top issue, the NRA lobbying being a big discussion, Delta, obviously, this now casts a huge light on the 7th or the 6th congressional district race.
I think it does. I think it could be if she were to capture her party's nomination for that office. I think it could be a very different race in the 6th district, having two women running in that race, and it could change the dialogue quite a bit and what the priority issues would be in that race.
Yeah, suddenly guns would be on the table. She has to get past the primary, of course, first.
She has to get past the primary, but to Michael's point, I think, you know, with a national boost, as we saw with Ossoff, I think that's entirely possible. The demographics are against her. She's African American. The district is at least 70% white voters. It's a district drawn for Republicans. She says that the topic of gun violence transcends race and age, and you know, and you have to admit the 6th district has some of the best public high schools in the state,
yeah.
And parents are very protective of that. So it's got possibilities.
You know, I think, Julianne, it's interesting to hear Michael tout this candidacy. Not that you're picking her over the other Democrats, but that you think it's exciting. Because, in fact, what she has done by not running for the state house is she could have won that seat. We're talking about whether there's going to be much of a power shift in the state capital. She was on a pretty fast path to being a pretty close to winning that seat, given how vulnerable the incumbent is.
I think she's probably looking at the issue more than she is the seat.
I think
that she is most concerned about doing everything she can to stop gun violence. So, I mean, I'm not surprised that she's taking this pulpit.
Yeah, well, and you have to remember, Karen Handel has been backed by the NRA last year. Mm-hmm. She hasn't been hesitant in past campaigns to show herself with a gun. I can remember her trip to the Heckler Koch arms plant down in Columbus in the 2010 race.
Yeah. All right.
But the Democratic side will likely not have the kind of funding that they had with the John Ossoff race. I mean, that was a special election. It was one campaign. There was money coming in from all over the country. There are many races on the table this year. So I think that dynamic is going to be dramatically different.
All right.
I think that's right.
Okay, let's move on. Thank you for a really good discussion about qualifying.
I have to step in really quick and correct this because I'm going to hear some feedback from
all right.
Lucy McBath. She is the national spokesperson for Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America.
Okay.
I wanted to get that organization name correct.
Okay. Spoken like a guy who's got to run for the party chairmanship, Michael. let's go through a couple of issues in the legislature fairly quickly. First up, Jim, let's talk. It looks like we're going to see votes in favor of putting new voting machines in place by the 2020 election. That's an expensive proposition.
Right. But it's one that resonates with Republicans and Democrats, as we've said here before. I think the next debate is going to be which system.
Absolutely.
And how impervious is it to hacking, or how reliable, how trustworthy is it?
We're looking – they are certainly going to look for – a paper trail, no matter what machine they pick, I assume. That's what most people are concerned about, is not having a paper trail, right?
I agree.
So it's going to probably be some type of option, just for clarity. It's not a paper ballot. It's not an electronic ballot. It's an electronic ballot that
leaves
feeds
a paper
out
trail.
A paper ballot so that you can count that way as well if there's a recount or such.
What's interesting about it is it's more complicated than it seems. If you go, dig down into some of the stories about this, there are people who are also concerned about whether the paper trail is done correctly, too. There are so many different voting systems. I remember back when Kathy Cox, Secretary of State Kathy Cox, wanted to bring in electronic voting machines. They went through a whole host of different vendors before they arrived at the one who that's now giving us a machine that's so outdated.
Right, right. They don't even have a Windows program that fits it.
Right.
It fits it anymore. But I would just remind everyone, historically, the biggest election ballot scandal we've ever had involved paper ballots in Telfair County, and where the dead voted by, in alphabetical order.
Right. But like Loretta said, this isn't a paper ballot. It's a paper trail.
Right. Right. So.
Well, you know, this is kind of where I'll take my chairman's hat off and put my cybersecurity hat
on. Yeah, you know this issue inside and out.
There's multiple issues with this. The first one is this is a statewide, you're looking at a statewide IT systems deployment over 27,000 machines across 159 counties. And to be able to select a vendor, go through all of the contractual information, the actual customization of the deployment, get it out and tested and ready by 2020 is one heck of a challenge.
Yeah, very aggressive.
That's very, very aggressive. And I know that there's already some officials within the Board of Elections who have said voice concerns about this because it's a very tight time frame. Secondly, it's an IT operating system. None are impervious to being hacked. As soon as it's rolled out, there's going to be people trying to crack it. So it's a continuous thing that we constantly have to do to stay on top of it. And I'm much more concerned about the process and procedures that we put around our electoral voting than I actually am the machines themselves. Not to say that I'm not concerned about the voting machines, but the processes in which we do this, if you guys remember back to last year's election when that passbook machine got stolen, that's a perfect example of a machine that's not encrypted and gets stolen.
I apologize for interrupting, but except we should point out to our listeners that this is your area of expertise. You've worked in cybersecurity and run a cybersecurity company that does work for the federal government, among other places, so you know this issue really well.
Yeah, it's concerning, put it that way. But I am happy that we're moving towards more verifiable systems and obviously more updated systems where, you know, operating systems are still in effect.
All right, let's, Jim, just a quick note. House Bill 605, which is dubbed the Hidden Predator Act, this is the bill that is supposed to extend the length of time, to extend the age by which a person who is claiming to have been the victim of sexual abuse as a child can, file a suit against the alleged perpetrator. It seems on the surface that it would be just a bill that everybody would jump on board, except this also makes the organizations that the people who are the alleged abusers work for vulnerable. And as a result of that, you have organizations like the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce, one of the Catholic Church's lobbying organizations, the Boy Scouts, and they're all being very quiet in how they oppose this.
Yeah, and this is going to be a hard one. This is a Jason Spencer bill. He doesn't have a whole lot of clout. But he has gotten some respect because past legislation on the same topic really played a role in revealing the Gymnastics USA trial there. So, but this is still going to be a hard one to get across the finish line in the next 9 days.
Loretta, you do a lot of work with business organizations down there. Have you been picking up anything about this bill?
No, I have not. I have not had any conversations.
Okay, but what do you think
about
this?
But I went back and I looked at the actual legislation, and I thought it was interesting that you have Jason Spencer, who is a conservative from South Georgia, and you have Mary Margaret Oliver, who is a liberal from Metro Atlanta, and
probably the best family lawyer in the Capitol,
and also Stacey Evans was an original co-signer on this, who's now running for governor on the Democratic ticket. And it passed unanimously in the House. Bills don't always, it's few and far between bills that pass unanimously. And I went back and looked at the actual legislation, and I know that entities, as they're defined in the bill, whether it's a business entity, an organization, or so forth, this it pertains to sexual abuse committed on or after July 1, 2018. So this does not, this is not retroactive. This begins on the 18th. So everybody kind of knows. It's not like they're going back years and years and years and that organizations are going to be held accountable for things that happened way mm-hmm. back when. Okay, you're on notice. This law is going into effect. And then it says that those entities, only if by a preponderance of the evidence, there is a finding of negligence on the part of the entity. So you have to have a preponderance of evidence that there was negligence for an entity to be held accountable.
That's a high bar.
That's a very high bar.
But the organizations I've just cited are, according to news reports, fighting it very vigorously.
They are fighting it, but it is a bipartisan bill. Like Loretta said, it passed unanimously. There are activists at the state capitol on both sides of the aisle that are working the Senate on behalf of this bill. Yes, there are a few senators that it seems are in opposition to it, but I think you have to maybe read some of those resumes and see how many of those people are actually connected with some of the organizations that are in opposition to this. So I think that this has, I think it definitely has a good shot in the Senate.
All right, we've got to get our second break out of the way. As we do, just a quick note, there are efforts to once again expand the list of illnesses, conditions covered by medical, medical marijuana has now been completely buried for the session. Not much chance it's going to be brought back, which is kind of maybe a little bit of a sad farewell for Alan Peake, who retires at the end of this session, who has been the champion of this cause for so long. And that bill is not going anywhere. I think it's the lieutenant governor, was it, Jim, who said we'll have a study commission on this?
Yeah, that was a kick the can announcement that came out yesterday. Basically, you know, it's I think it's recognition by Casey Cagle, who's running for governor, of course, that this is a potent issue. One GOP rival, Michael Williams, is in favor of what Alan Peake is trying to do. Lieutenant Governor is a little bit more circumspect, so he's named a study commission to come up with a topic after the election.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I think Clay Tippins is the candidate that Alan Peake has endorsed and that he has spoken with on this topic.
Yes.
And they seem to be in agreement on what needs to happen here. I have no doubt that Representative Peake will continue on this mission post his legislative career.
All right, I've got to get a break in, and let's do it right now. We'll come back. We got so many subjects to talk about. How will we get through them all? Stay tuned.
I'm Ira Flatow. When did you first get captivated by science? Astronaut Leland Melvin says his interest was sparked literally when his mother gave him a chemistry set.
You know, I created this explosion. I burned her carpet. She ran in the room and, you know, I got a spanking, but my brain was activated to science.
Activate your brain to science on Science Friday from PRI.
It's this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Let me reintroduce the panel. Michael Owens from the Cobb County Democratic Party. He chairs it. Julianne Thompson, Republican strategist and activist in the party. Loretta Lepore, a Republican who worked for Governor Sonny Perdue and who's very active down as a lobbyist at the Capitol. And Jim Galloway, of course, from the AJC. Very quickly, give us a preview. What's Sunday's column?
Well, I'm looking at Lucy McBath.
Oh, you are going to do that?
And we one thing we didn't mention about her, she's a former Delta flight attendant.
Yes, so the Delta NRA thing comes
works into
play.
That.
All right, look, we really do. There's so many things happening in national news right now, so let's just take our pick on just one of them. And I guess what we should do is talk a little bit about this subject.
Tonight we learned about an official invitation from Kim Jong-un to meet Trump.
Wow.
This can only mean one thing. Mm. Dennis Rodman is going to get the Nobel Peace Prize.
Stephen Colbert. All right, look, a disclaimer at least from me. I wouldn't even begin to say that I can unravel whether or not the president having a meeting with a dictator of North Korea is a good idea. I don't know geopolitics in this area. If any of you do, have at it. But I think what's in some ways more interesting is, first of all, you've got to say Trump probably deserves some credit for helping make this happen. But I'm interested in it also in which it changes the dialogue, the story that the media has been so engaged with, Stormy Daniels, the Russia probe, all the things that Trump has been contending with, Loretta. He's, you know, this is going to dominate the news for a little bit of time, I think. No?
I think as it gets closer and if it actually happens and as we begin to see this it come to fruition, that it might begin to dominate the news. But it seems to be that, you know, some of these other topics have really got the media's attention.
I think you're right. Let me change the way I said that. You're right. Stormy Daniels, and there's a brand new story about the fact that the Trump lawyer who was involved in this $130,000 payment to her actually used Trump Organization email to communicate with the Stormy Daniels side. So let me restate that and throw it to you, Juliet. It's not going to dominate, but it's going to give the people who are pulling for Trump something to talk about. And it is one of those things that you have to look and say, well, maybe the president's tough behavior hasn't been such a bad thing.
Well, when you have people in the media that are definitely not fans of Donald Trump coming out and applauding this effort, I think it is a game changer for him. I think it's going over well among the Republican base, and I think it's going over well across the aisle.
Galloway?
Well, I would just remind everyone that one is a fellow who has reneged on pledge after pledge after pledge, and the other one is Donald Trump. who has gone right only to shift left, only to shift right again and then left again. I will be very surprised if this meeting in fact comes off.
Well, you know what, Michael? I think that's a really good point. I mean, this is the president who wanted to show love for DACA recipients, who thought that we should get tougher on guns. We should take guns away from people who have mental illnesses without due process. Mm-hmm. We saw what happened with both of those things. And so I think Galloway makes a point that is at least worth considering here. It's going to be fascinating to watch in the next couple months whether or not the president can stay on track on this whole idea of meeting with the North Korean leader.
Sure. I mean, I'm no conservative, but ladies, you probably could help me out here. I think the heart of it is Trump himself is not a conservative. I don't know really what to call him. But he's a piece of work. So he decides what he wants to do, and I think then he kind of gets pulled back from the right about what the conservative view should be, because you have the Donald Trump view, and then you have the administration view of administration sometimes, and the further right view, I think. And that all kind of gets mixed up into a soup to where you're not really sure what you're going to get. But one thing I will say about our president, and I've said this in open forums before, is that If there's one good thing that I can say from a geopolitical standpoint is that fear being struck into other countries by means of deterrence can work and can bring people to the table. But I also am very concerned because of this overall sense that Putin has somehow played Trump and continues to do so, that Kim Jong-un may feel that he has that same opportunity.
You know, Loretta, we're operating so deeply in our own silos right now that if I say I think Michael in this case makes a point that perhaps the president's tough talk with Kim Jong-un might have had some impact on whether he's now thinking he might want to negotiate. If I say that out loud, if Michael said, we're going to get tweets are going to come at us about what a Republican show this is. Why are we so reluctant to say that every now and then the president might in fact have done something not so bad?
Well, I don't. In this case, I think that Michael's correct, and that and Julianne mentioned also that we've seen folks, you know, even folks that have worked for Hillary Clinton, have worked for the Obama administration, come out and say, you know, something is working here, and giving credit for this potential meeting, at least getting to this stage of the game.
Okay, but the problem is, go ahead.
And to Michael's other point about whether Donald Trump is in fact a conservative, I think we all acknowledge that he is not guided by ideology. That is not why he ran, and that is not why he won. And he ran on certain issues that resonated with the base of the party, the Republican Party. And when you look at things like the tariffs this week, those are the things that he's doing that he promised he would do. And you've seen almost every GOP leader come out and speak against it, including our own senators.
Yeah, and we have both of our U.S. senators. Jim, yesterday we had the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, in Atlanta, and he, even as the president was signing his executive order on tariffs, Paul Ryan was telling an audience up there at Home Depot that he opposed him.
Well, it's interesting to see hear the language. Both Paul Ryan and David Perdue were using kind of the same phraseology Wednesday and Thursday.
Laser-like focus.
Yeah, let's narrow this thing so that they can reduce what they consider to be damage. I thought the more interesting comment came from Johnny Isaacson, quite frankly, where he put out a statement after Trump signed the tariff resolution that called this simply a tax increase.
He called it a tax increase. Yep.
And that in the Republican world, that's pretty absolute stuff.
To go back to the North Korea situation for a moment, while I think it's fair to say that President's tough talk may have had some impact on this, and there's no reason not to give him some credit for that. We also know that he's dismantled the State Department. We have no ambassador to North Korea. We have no way of believing that he has a strategy about how he is going to approach talks with North Korea. So
we also know that Kim Jong-un walked away from the last agreement with the U.S. after only 14 days.
All right. So that's all the time we have for this show. We end with North Korea. And a little about Stormy Daniels, and that story is going to continue as well. So let me say thank you to Michael Owens, to Julianne Thompson, to Loretta Lepore, and to you, Jim Galloway, for being with us. So we live in interesting times, Galloway.
It's a curse. It's a curse. What can I say?
All right. Remember, we are here on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays at 2 o'clock. If you're not able to listen to us on those days, subscribe to our podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, or watch us on now Facebook Live. We love having you tune in to see us in video. One way or the other, please continue your interest in Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. Appreciate your being with us all week. I hope everybody has a wonderful weekend. Take care.